G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 156th, Henry VIII, part 12. My name's Dick Newman, and I see Joe Biden, Sleepy Joe, has picked Kamala Harris to run with him as vice president to try and bring in the youth vote. So what's Kamala got to say?
What else do we know about this population, 18 through 24? They are stupid. That is why we put them in dormitories. And they have a resident assistant. They make really bad decisions.
Yeah, maybe voting for Kamala won't be a bad decision they make. Let's get on with it.
What a day, a year, a life it is. You know, well you know, you had it coming to you. Now there's not a lot I can do.
1975, Supertramp with Dreamer there, and Jane Seymour had been dreaming of a handsome young prince coming in to sweep her off her feet. Well, she put up with a middle-aged, fat, balding king. Well, we'll see. She's the one who gets presented as quiet, humble, and submissive in history, happy to dress up as a matron and spank Henry on his bot-bot, or just as happy to dress up as a schoolgirl, run away and hide, then let Henry find her and give her a damn good rogering. Something like that. Then last week it was all downhill for Anne, wasn't it? Done for treason and executed. I was just thinking that Catherine, our Spanish princess, didn't get no obituary from us, and that's okay with me. She had such a sad life. I didn't want to do it all over again, the poor old love. Another unhappy princess in history. But let's talk about Anne a bit. What did you make of her? Let's start at the end. And do I need to convince you that this was judicial murder? Do I really need to convince you? That court case was total bullshit in a time where normal court cases weren't the best anyway. The only thing the prosecution had was Mark Smeaton's confession, and that would not have been hard to get. Allow yourself to be in Mark's place, and here I am as Cromwell. Now, here's the deal. You are going to die. Make no mistake, your fate is sealed, you will die. Confess now to me, then confess in court, and confess one last time at your execution. I will guarantee you get a beheading, and I will pay that headsman to make a nice, quick, clean job of it. Or, on the other hand, don't confess, and I shall torture you at my leisure, making sure that the torture continues after you've confessed. Then your death will be slow and very painful, and I will pay that executioner to make it the nastiest job he's ever done. Pretty easy then to get Mark Smeaton to say whatever words you want him to say. The other four guys went down to provoke moral outrage against Anne. Pretty much all the anti-Anne stuff we get from historians writing after the time. The contemporary authors gave us an intelligent woman who was focused on helping out ordinary types and was against the corruption of the church. If we work from the basis that just being female will get you negative comments, then Anne did very well from her contemporaries. Henry chased Anne for 7 years, then finally married the love of his life, only to murder her 3 years later. Now, in Henry's brain, this would not have been murder at all. Anne committed adultery, which we recall is fine for men. It's all good for men, but for women, it's treason. Perhaps part of his brain knew it was murder, but a guy like Henry would keep that voice in his brain nice and quiet, and just work on convincing himself that he was right. Anne's mistake, I think, was the exercise of power. Henry and Cromwell were not ready to share, nor will guys like that ever be ready to share. But for us, it's rest in peace, Anne Boleyn. For me, she was pretty marvellous, and hot if you watch the Tudors. Yeah, that Natalie Dormer. Oh yeah, she drips sex appeal, that girl. 2nd of May 1536, Anne was arrested. 14th of May, her marriage was annulled, she was no longer queen, and baby Betty was a bastard. 15th of May, court case, guilty. Henry went into party mode. 19th of May, Anne was executed. 20th of May, Henry was betrothed to Jane Seymour. The fucker. Anne, though, will be mourned. For starters, there's the poor scholar she was looking after, and then the reformers, who had found a champion in Anne. Now, Jane Seymour, it was just a couple of months ago in March that Henry sent her a note with some cash, so we tend to date that as when he got seriously interested in what she kept in her knickers. 2nd of May, Anne was arrested and Jane was sent away from court. Now, Henry had to look chaste. 14th of May, the day before Anne's trial, and Jane was moved into Sir St. Tom More's old house at Chelsea, and that's nice and close. It was Sir Nicholas Carew, master of the horse and recent garter knight, who was sent to get her. Chapuis will report she is splendidly served by the king's cook and other officers. She is also most splendidly dressed. So she's moved into Sir St. Tom's house, and there's a note from Henry saying, "I'll let you know when Anne has been found guilty, as soon as the cook gets up to speed and tells her she's guilty." Cranmer then proclaimed that the marriage to Anne was off, and Henry is single again. 19th of May, Anne is executed, and Cranmer issues a dispensation for Henry to marry something like his third cousin. Okay, you're saying, hang on, Dick, you told us that the Seymours were bits of nobodies, and now you're saying they're related to the king. Well, it seems this might have been through one of Henry's mistresses, and these lot will soon wake up that there are in-law relationships or mistress relationships, and that these are different to blood relationships, and doesn't matter anyway. The church just issues dispensations if you pay up some cash. Yeah, so Jane's not particularly royal, it's just that she's related to somebody that Henry had fucked previously. Still, Henry wanted it all to be clean, so he's got that dispensation. 20th of May, and Anne's corpse is still cooling, while Henry and Jane are betrothed in secret, of course. Time to slow shit down. The optics of this would be pretty bad. Well, it's pretty bad. You think it's pretty bad, don't you? He's just killed one wife and then he gets betrothed the next day. So Jane will remain at Chelsea for about 10 days. And she comes to York Place, Wolsey's old house. And on the 2nd of June, Henry and Jane were married. Off we go to Greenwich, and on the 4th of June, Jane is proclaimed Queen. 2 days later, and Jane's brother Edward will be made Viscount Beauchamp. Henry's first divorce took 7 years. His second took less than 7 weeks. That's what can happen when you have a Tom Cromwell on your team. So 2 weeks later, Tom Boleyn is stripped of the Lord Privy Seal, and that will go to Cromwell. 3 weeks after that, Tom, the blacksmith's son, will be made Lord Cromwell of Wimbledon. Yeah, he's a baron now. Now, last time we chatted about Cromwell, he'd started the census of the churchy assets. Biggest deal since the Domesday Book in 1086. His agents are doing this work, and they will, of course, be hated. We all know that Tom's not taking stock just for fun. Meanwhile, the hated inspectors were sending back very useful information about monks being on the booze and playing cards and banging away wherever they could. It's not like the good old days when you might be able to count on some monks to come out and help belt up visiting Danes. These guys are pretty much past their use-by date. This evidence is just what Cromwell needs to convince Parliament that we need more church reform. These churchy types are just getting fatter and richer, and they're not contributing anything much to society. The heads of the monasteries were voted in by the brothers, and the brothers might just vote in the guy who's the most lax, so they can all lead carefree lives. The movers and shakers and the thinkers will be on Team Cromwell on this. Ordinary types, not so much. A generation later, John Fox will write, "We are all bound unto that one man, and otherwise we would be miserable. The great flocks of monks are banished, which else today would have possessed England in such great numbers that 10 Cromwells would scarcely suffice to banish them again." So in that final session of the Reformation Parliament, Cromwell introduced a bill to dissolve all monasteries with an income of less than £200 a year. The proposal was supported by the reports from his field guys that told a sordid tale of vice and corruption, and that's what Cromwell was stopping. Nothing to do with making Henry richer. The Commons will pass the legislation, and their press release will say this: "It is and shall be much more to the pleasure of Almighty God, and for the honour of this his realm, that the possessions of such spiritual religious houses, now being spent, spoiled, and wasted for the increase and maintenance of sin, should be used and converted to better uses." Yeah, we could start thinking about stupid foreign wars if we wanted to. God would like that. Lords will pass it. No need for a press release from them. They're the Lords. We'll then create a court of augmentations of the King's revenue. They will have power to collect lands, property and goods of any kind of the abbeys and dispose of those assets in any way they see fit which would be most profitable to the Crown. It will be headed by a new Vicar General, and let's see, who can we make Vicar General? Who can we make? Oh, Cromwell? Cromwell, okay, Cromwell it is. The thing will need around 30 staff. Cromwell, do you happen to know 30 people? Say, I don't know, mates of yours, who could run this thing? You do? Great. Cromwell can staff it too. He makes it all so easy, doesn't he? Cromwell then had just gotten another huge leap in power. He'll be able to say who gets all this lovely land from the church and what price they might pay for it. So the downside is that Cromwell has just gotten all this new power, and today we'd look to put in all sorts of checks and balances to try and avoid corruptions. At least try to avoid corruption. But they didn't think like that back then. Having said that, it's about to change in England, and that'll be thanks to Tom Cromwell. The government is growing, so Tom will need to invent a bureaucratic government to cope with this stuff. We'll be going from the King's mates who provide all the advice and start to move towards paid professionals to provide professional advice. Tom will slowly replace the Boleyn faction in the Privy Chamber with these guys. And these are common types who are intelligent and capable rather than guys who just happen to be born to Lord Fuckwit or something. I've got no idea why in the US they keep a system that allows the President to just appoint his mates as Secretary of this and that rather than the UK or Australian system where we have paid professionals to head up government departments and elected members of Parliament to be ministers. But there you go, in the US, and then you get people like Betsy DeVos, and nobody knows why she's a thing. And I don't think Betsy DeVos knows why she's a thing either. Seems to be dumb as... No, anyway. On top of everything else, Cromwell is getting himself into an indispensable position as Henry's right-hand man. Now, I should say almost indispensable. Everybody and everything is dispensable to a sociopath. Just ask Wolsey. The legislation provided that the highest-ranking man in each county would investigate the state of religious houses in their area, take a detailed inventory, and estimate the wealth of the place. One more thing, how many monks will you be making unemployed if we happen to dissolve the place? Oddly enough, now that we don't have Cromwell's men in there investigating the religious houses, the reports will become more favourable. Meanwhile, Tom has his guys out dissolving those smaller monasteries, and they're setting a cracking pace. A receiver is appointed to get the baby Jesus toys, the vestments, the gold plate, the bells, the pews, whatever, everything has value. We'll even take the lead from the roof to recycle. Our local workers won't want to do the work. No problem, plenty of men in London happy to be fly-in, fly-out workers. Or ride-in, ride-out, probably. The guys come as a team. You've got a team of carpenters, smiths, plumbers, and their assistants, and they strip the building, look to deconstruct it, in need, brick by brick, to be repurposed. Now, this is not making the locals happy. Some of these buildings were centuries old, and the baby Jesus toys were considered community property. We have an eyewitness. It would have made a heart of flint to have melted and wept to have seen the breaking up of the house, and their sorrowful departing, and the sudden spoil that fell that day of their departure from the house. And every person had everything good cheap, except the poor monks, the friars, and nuns, that had no money to bestow of anything. Yeah, just to complete the job, we had looters in to see what they could nick in the confusion, or take away any tiny thing that Cromwell's guys thought had no value or too little value to cart away. It would have pitied any heart to see what tearing up of the lead there was, and plucking up of the boards, and throwing down the spares. And the tombs of the church were all broken, and the things of price either spoiled, carped away, or defaced to the uttermost. Yeah, so we're happy to dig up graves as well. You know, people got buried with jewellery and so on. We want that. Now, you might have one of those idyllic English country villages in your mind, my dear listener. But it's not just the rural monasteries. Plenty of towns had multiple monasteries, with some coming in on that under £200 test. Here's what the Venetian ambassador will say in about 20 years. On the banks of the river there are many large palaces making a very fine show, but the city is much disfigured by the ruins of a multitude of churches and monasteries belonging heretofore to friars and nuns.
Tell me, who is that riding down the river later? Arthur, who is that riding down the river later? Wrote the book on the seven seals.
Yeah, a bit of Tom Waits there with some good old time religion. That's what the people want. Round one of the dissolution will see 376 religious houses gone. The sale of goods will bring Henry over £100,000, or let's say $32 million in current terms. On top of that, Henry will get an extra £32,000 annually from the land. To give you an idea, the current total income for Henry is about £250,000, so an extra £32,000 is pretty decent. What are you thinking, my dear listener? Is it that if you can get this from the smallest religious houses, then what could you get from the big buggers? That's what I'm thinking, but we've got a problem. While Cromwell's guys bag the small places, they praise the big ones as having high moral standards, probably to get some contrast in for our parliamentarians. Some of the smaller houses had avoided being shut up, although the commissioners found things to charge them with so we could get a big fat fine. Also, Henry actually refounded two of them, Bisham Abbey and Stixwood Priory. This tells us there was no original master plan to do over the lot of them. These guys are thinking a bit slower than we might be. Cromwell, though, might just be being cautious. Henry had wife one, Catholic, wife two, reformer, but wanted to benefit the poor from those monasteries, and now we've got wife three, ex-novice and very Catholic, and not liking all this destruction of religious houses. And now I'm back on Cromwell and Dead Anne, so let's pop her back into life. Cromwell on the surface appeared to be on Team Anne for a long time. February, 3 months before Anne's death, he ordered Lady Formerly Princess Mary to hand over a cross that Catherine had given her. Chapuis was outraged, and Cromwell told him, "Sorry, boss's orders, mate." At the same time, Chapuis was reporting that Cromwell was still on Team Anne. April and Chapuis will change his reports to Anne and Cromwell are fighting. Chapuis was trying to get the story. Would Henry be marrying Frankie Big Nose's daughter? Cromwell will say Henry's just browsing through the catalogue of available ladies and checking his Tinder account while remaining chaste in continuing his marriage with Anne. "This he said so coldly as to make me suspect the contrary, especially as he said so, not knowing what countenance to put on. He leaned against the window in which we were, putting his hand before his mouth to avoid smiling or to conceal it, saying afterwards that the French might be assured of one thing, that if the king, his master, were to take another wife, he would not seek for her among them." Yeah, no Frenchy princesses for Henry. Thing is, though, Cromwell is working for Henry, and who the fuck knows? He may wake up in the morning, having had a wet dream about Anne, and be head over heels in love with her again. Cromwell has to keep his options open. Publicly, Anne and Cromwell, both being pragmatic, will keep up the show that they are good buddies. The real problem came when Anne was interfering with foreign policy. She may have been trying to play those German princes against Super Sausage Chuck to try and force him into accepting royal supremacy over the church. Whatever was her motivation, it did not suit Cromwell. Then Cranmer, who was Cromwell's man, will join Anne over the dissolution of the monasteries, and things are going downhill for Tom Cromwell. Cromwell will start buddying up to Sir Nicholas Carew and the Seymour boys to start aligning himself with the new girl, Jane Seymour. Carew was also good buddies with Anne Hayter, Charles Brandon. Nicholas Carew had been solidly on Team Catherine and Mary, but he finally saw they were gone, so the Catholic Jane Seymour is his new hope. Cromwell is also sucking up to Charles Brandon. Henry told Cromwell to get word to Brandon to rip it up him for various minor annoyances. Cromwell will write to Sir Richard Rich the fucker, saying, "Look, tell Brandon what Henry's upset about, but also tell him I'm his good mate, so don't worry too much about it." Then get Charles to write a hey good buddy letter to the king, and it will all be good. I shall make it so. Cromwell then, our radical and religious political reformer, is getting friendly with Team Conservative, and we like the church and we only want nobles running things. He's an absolute pragmatist. These guys probably despise Cromwell, but he's the big swinging dick in court, so it would suit them at the moment to buddy up with him as well. They would see they could use him so that their faction can get back in and have their girl as queen to support them. In the historical fiction, you often see Cromwell stuck like glue to Henry, but that wasn't the case. Cromwell will never be as close to Henry as Wolsey had been. After Wolsey, Henry decided that nobody should be that close. Cromwell won't be given the free rein that Wolsey had had either. Still, he's pretty much the number one man after Henry. Following Catherine's death, relationships with Super Sausage Chuck improved, as Cromwell had predicted to Chapuis. With Henry and the sausage getting friendly, Frankie Big Nose decided he should get friendly with Henry too. Henry instructed his ambassadors to answer all questions to the Frenchies in an extremely general fashion. He wanted this friendly stuff to last. Cromwell, though, can't help himself and will stir Henry up with the Frenchie ambassador until Henry rips it into the poor old Frenchie. He can get away with that, but Cromwell will be disrespectful to the Frenchies in a conversation with Chapuis, and it's dangerously close to being naughty, Cromwell. Cromwell has written to Chapuis for a secret meeting. Chapuis said, "Sorry, busy at that time. Why not just write down what you want to tell me?" Cromwell will write, "I can't put it in writing because what I want to tell you is independent of Henry and his instructions, but you and Super Sausage will like what I have to say." Chapuis will be off like a shot to get this gossip, and we can listen in. Cromwell will say that he's dealing with the Frenchies. He's never done anything to prejudice his dealings with Chapuis. Nice to know. Then it's Henry wants to be a good friend to the Sausages, even if Henry doesn't really know it himself. And his council also want him to be your friend. Chapuis will say, "Oh, that's nice, while thinking, what the fuck's he on about?" Cromwell will get all agitated that he can't get his message across. "Look, the Frenchies are just playing Henry, and I'd rather be hung from the highest steeple than have anything to do with those fuckers. Now look, Chapuis, we're in negotiations with your mob in Germany, and it's going to go really well. Henry will agree to whatever terms you put down. I'll make it happen. And you know I'm a can-do type of guy, and just look what I've achieved here in England. Trouble is, I'm just Henry's offsider, so I can't treat directly with your guy, Chuck. So look, get Chuck to start the negotiations with some offers of his own, and it'll all go well." Now, Chapuis, like us, is going to be a bit sceptical about all this. It looks like Cromwell's still playing games. They'll have another meeting, and this time Chapuis will report, "Yeah, I'm in, okay. I think you're fair dinkum, Tom." Chapuis will present Cromwell with a letter from Super Sausage, and Cromwell will receive it with great reverence, giving the letter a nice big kiss before opening it. And sure enough, Chuck's making overtures, so Cromwell's plan is working. One thing, though, is that Chuck wants Henry to kiss and make up with the Pope, which is not what Cromwell would want. Even so, he's fully on board with getting a treaty done with Chuck and not doing a deal with Big Nose. Allow me to spell this out for you in case you haven't smelled it out for yourself. It's Cromwell and his London merchant buddies and their international business with the countries in the Super Sausage Empire, and they don't do so much trade with the Frenchies. As usual, this is all about money for Cromwell. Cromwell then will do lots of business with Chapuis, there'll be lots of visits and chats, but when the Frenchie ambassador comes calling to Tom, it's, "Yeah, tell him I'm out." The story goes that it was Cromwell, the assistance of George Boleyn, who herded Chapuis into the position in the church where he had to acknowledge Anne as queen. And sure enough, the next day, Henry, who had been avoiding Chapuis, agreed to see him. Marvellous for Chapuis to be back in with the king. But then the dickwit will be telling Henry, oh, I had a chat with Cromwell. He told me you want to do a deal with Chap, including making you one of the Pope's best boys again, and getting Lady Mary back to Princess Mary. And that's when Henry will hit the roof and rip it right up Cromwell, who has to wander off. He's just totally pissed off, Cromwell. Then Chapuis will cop a bit from Henry too. Give me your proposals in writing, says Henry. Well, fuck me, says Chapuis. Nobody's ever doubted my word before, and Cromwell never gives me anything in writing. Henry will then chop down every one of Chapuis' proposals and say, Chuck is a total ingrate. Without me, he'd be emperor of fuck all. Off they go, with Cromwell catching up with Chapuis, saying, that was a shit sandwich, and look, mate, in future, let's make sure we have other guys with us to make sure we've got a good record of what was said. And confidentially, everything I said before was Henry's idea, not mine. Looks to me, though, like Cromwell had overdone the international stuff and he's just trying to protect the various trade deals. This, though, might be the start of the end of Cromwell, the all-supreme guy in England. The tone of his letters to Henry will start to change. Stuff like, I'm telling you this even though I know somebody as smart as you doesn't need this advice. Just saying how it seems to me and how I think other guys would react to it. While Cromwell is getting more humble, Henry is getting more disdainful, calling Cromwell a fool if he makes a mistake. A report also shows that Henry is sometimes getting a bit physical, giving Cromwell a slap to the poor old head. That's just one report, but again, it's sociopathic behaviour. Raise and praise someone and then start demeaning them. Cromwell, on the other hand, seems to have been a pretty peaceful type, rarely losing his temper, and if he does, he gets over it pretty quickly. Cromwell will have his man, Ralph Sadler, moved into court. The basis was that he could help move messages quickly, but Ralph is there to keep an eye on things. Ralph will also regularly deliver gifts to the king from Cromwell. Ralph's a good operator, so he'll soon be appointed Hanoper of the Chancery, and by 1536 he'll be a gentleman in the Privy Chamber. Cromwell will get him elected to Parliament, so it's all going well again. Cromwell himself looks to have avoided court for a while after his altercation with Henry. Smart move. We move on to the obvious attraction of James Seymour, but is this just a fad for Henry? Courtiers are moving towards the Seymours and away from the Boleyns. What's a Cromwell to do? Anne looks to be cornered, and we all know that's when things get dangerous, when somebody's cornered, and it looks like Anne has set her sights on Tom Cromwell. Now, Super Sausage Chuck wrote to Chapuis with a change of plan. He now wants Henry to stay married to Anne. If he doesn't, then he might marry somebody else and get a legit boy who will be the heir, so Chuck reckons that staying with Anne will give his cousin Mary the best shot at being heir to the big chair. Cromwell will also make this connection and decide that his proposed treaty with Chap was perhaps a bad move. A Queen Mary would be the end of Cromwell. Anne, of course, is pushing for the worst of all, a treaty for the Frenchies. So far as Chapuis is concerned, it will be Tom Cromwell who will mastermind the whole affair to bring down Anne. For Cromwell, it's a matter that he probably couldn't afford to leave Anne alive. He's seen those movies where the psychotic killer comes back for revenge, and Anne is an expert at wheedling her way back to Henry. Having worked out his plan, Cromwell will arrest Mark Smeaton. Cromwell's nephew, Richard, will be entrusted with this letter to Henry. Your Majesty will understand that, jealous of your honour, and seeing certain things passing in your palace, I determined to investigate and discover the truth. Your Majesty will recollect that Mark has hardly been in your service for 4 months, and has only £100 salary, and yet all the court notices his splendour, and that he has spent a large sum for these jousts, all of which has aroused suspicion in the minds of certain gentlemen. And I have examined Mark, who has made a confession, which I enclose to your Majesty in this letter. Now, Cromwell will be writing to people that he was totally shocked by the revelations that Anne's ladies had made. These women could no longer contain their secrets and had spontaneously come out with them. And it's all abominable this and detestable that. And even after the trial, Cromwell will be saying some of it was so horrible it didn't come out in the trial. Too horrible, too shocking to be revealed. And you know the rest, but by the way, for Hilary Mantel fans, the part where nobody thought of a coffin for Anne was correct. She was buried in an old arrow chest, and Cromwell's victory over Anne was complete. Now, we got Henry and Jane married on the 30th of May, 1536. People all over England are crossing out the H and A. Oh, no, they're just crossing out the A's and that have replaced the C's, and now it's H and J's all over the place. Cromwell is full of praise for Jane Seymour and emphasising her virtue. That's virginity for us. The court will have a sudden big change in personnel. The Boleyn faction are out and the Seymour faction are in. Now, one exception to this will be Jane Parker, a.k.a. Jane Boleyn, a.k.a. Lady Rochford, the now widow of George Boleyn. Was it a reward for telling on George? Could be. I can't come up with another reason why she should be returned to court just as the Boleyns are getting the boot. Maybe we will. Now, don't be thinking it's all champagne and reefers for Jane Boleyn. The assets of the Five Guys who died, and of course Anne, are all Henry's now. In comes the royal officers to take stock of everything of George's, and of course, you know by now, I mean everything, and that includes Jane's nice frocks. Jane will have a go at hiding some stuff in a chest, but Henry's men will be very thorough. These guys even record things like some broken beads that she had. Now, that's probably a rosary. Mind you, those beads are made of gold, white bone and pearl, so, yeah, they're worth something. There's our poor Jane, then, with the king's men rummaging around in a knickers and bras drawer. Well, knickers and bras haven't been invented yet, but you get the picture. Bunch of men rummaging around your house, finding your best vibrators and your handcuffs and other items described as adult toys. It's not nice, but her status is currently widow of a traitor. In come the vultures to Cromwell, looking for the money earners, the landers that these guys had. And here we get the story of one Andrew Flammock, who made Henry laugh when he farted. So he scored the constableship of Kenilworth. Yeah, great selection process there, Henry. Included in the vultures will be Jane's dear old dad, who will get some of the jobs and a bit of George's land. Jane, of course, will score nothing, although it's hard to see that she didn't keep some clothes or personal effects. Now, you might recall, back when George and Jane got together, the families came up with the jointure. That's the prenup that says if George died, then the Boleyns would come up with some assets for Jane to live off. So Jane will be looking to Sir Tom Boleyn, who's just lost a son and a daughter, and told his third kiddy Mary to fuck right off. Yeah, so Jane's looking for Sir Tom Boleyn to do the right thing at this time. If only Jane had given him a grandson, but Tom right now is thinking about himself. In fact, Tom's will says his non-existent grandson from George and Jane would have inherited nicely, but that human doesn't exist. Now, the jointure specified that Jane should get land in Norfolk and Buckingham with three manors. The law specified that if that land couldn't be handed over for any reason, then the father-in-law would pay 10% of the amount that the father had put up on an annual basis. Okay, did I do that well? Yeah. Jane's dad put up a certain amount, and now Tom's supposed to pay 10% of that on an annual basis. Now, Lord Morley had put up £666, so 10% of that is £66. You've done that some yourself, haven't you? But you may have also forgotten that Henry had chipped in the same amount himself. So Sir Tom Boleyn was going to pay £132 a year, until Lord Morley pointed out that, oh no, Henry had chipped in that other £666. So Tom will only pay £66, and I'm sure Jane thanked her dad for reminding Tom about that. What a fucker that dad is. Well, probably just stupid. Jane then had £66 to live on. Now, Georgia thought nothing of spending like £50 on a gold cup, but those days are gone. To give you an idea, the fabric for a black satin cloak would cost about £5. So for Jane, £66 a year is poverty. Jane will observe Elizabeth Savage, widow of the executed Brereton, who will have some lands restored to her and then send a horsey to Cromwell with a thank you note. Jane's off to talk to Cromwell. Well, write to him. You can't get in to see Cromwell. He's too busy. There'll be lots of flattery in the letter, so let's get to what she wants. She'd like some of George's stuff back, please, and a better deal for the jointure payments. Please ask Henry for some of George's stuff and his plate. Henry's got tons of it. He doesn't need any more, but it really helped me. And don't forget, baby Jesus will love him all the more. And of course you, Tom, will be rewarded by God for helping a poor, desolate widow. Henry will lean on Tom Boleyn, who will up the £66 to £100, while still saying he was legally right when he'd come up with £66, and, well, I was young, I lived high on £50 a year, so it's all very generous on my part. Yeah, good on you, Tom. For Jane, though, this would certainly be the first time she's had a go at looking after herself, with her dad or George having done it all for her previously. First go, and she's had a win. Well done. By now, Jane would be in her early 30s, and while she'd had a win, she'll still be dependent on men. Not her fault, it's the times. Still, she's a widow with an independent income, so it might be a half-decent catch for a younger son of a minor noble. But not a good catch. Jane's no baby machine, which is rather unattractive. Yeah, she hadn't had a kiddie at all. £100 a year and no land, so small chance that a handsome somebody will be knocking at the door. Her best bet is to try and get back into court. Cromwell had helped her once and may do again. But will there be that quid pro quo thing that King Donald never ever did with Ukraine? No, 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 no. And anyway, forget Donald. This is about Jane Boleyn and Tom Cromwell. We don't know how Tom did it, but he did it. And Jane Boleyn will be in Jane Seymour's privy chamber. Well done, Tom. Congratulations, Jane Boleyn. And what's in it for Tom? Where's our quid pro quo? Jane promised Tom her prayers and services. I think we can take that to mean that our clever Tom now has a listening device in Jane Seymour's privy chamber. Yes, Jane Boleyn is his spy. Yeah, haven't had a Charlie's Angel movie for a while, have we? We'll have to put up with Jane Seymour being our stunning spy. Sir Nicholas Carew and his Conservative faction will now start pressing for Lady, formerly Princess Mary, to be retitled Princess, formerly Lady, but now back to Princess Mary. And they're all wearing red baseball caps saying MMLA, Make Mary Legit Again. Yeah, Cromwell won't be liking that. Cromwell had only teamed up with this mob to bring down Anne Boleyn. He's out of that particular club now. Back to Jane Seymour. She's been declared Queen of England, but it's not God approved just yet. Henry isn't rushing into the holy oil and anointing thingy. He wants to wait a few months until we have a pregnant Jane Seymour to wander around Westminster to get the silly hat. While we're not doing the silly hat thingy, we can still have some royal performance art. Time to open Parliament, and there'll be a big flotilla along the Thames. Chapuis will set up a pavilion and dress all fancy. As the royal barge comes into sight, he'll send out two boatloads of musicians to salute the King and Queen. Yeah, the new Queen's Catholic, so Chapuis approves. To really show this, he has a 40-gun salute blast out. Hold my beer, says Henry, and the Tower will give a 400-gun salute. Everybody's happy, except for our poet Tom White. Yeah, he's not happy. These bloody days have broken my heart. My lust, my youth did then depart, and blind desire of estate, who haste to climb, seeks to revert, of truth circa regatonant. Yeah, that's around the throne the lightning strikes. The bell tower showed me such a sight, that in my head sticks day and night. There did I learn out a great, for all favour, glory or might, that yet circa regatonant. I'll just excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, while I have a good old sob. Okay, have my sob. Yeah, so the tower that just a few days earlier was all doom and gloom and Anne's blood, it's now all very pretty with streamers and banners and the sun is shining and the world's a good place to be. Next day, and Jane can watch her groom ride off to Parliament and declare that her kiddies will be heirs to the big chair. Well, Henry has to go to the churchy types for a magic show first, and he's off for the official parliamentary opening. Audley's speech will go on for half an hour, and fair enough, there's a lot of explaining to do. Yes, Parliament, since last time we met, it came to light that the former Queen was a total slut, and sadly that's treason, so we had to do her. We then begged Henry to please take a new wife, please, Henry. He was reluctant. I don't know if I want a new wife. But we all begged and begged and begged, so Henry said, all right. He then picked a beautiful maiden who was chaste, pure, and fertile. Now that's done, he wants to provide for the welfare of us all by giving us the security of a new succession. Okay, you mob got that? Good. Let us pray God to send offspring to our most excellent prince. Let us give thanks that he has preserved him for us, safe from so many and so great dangers, and leave us thus to his posterity. Okay, over to Jane Seymour to get up the spout now. A week later, I'll be off to the Abbey for the full mob, King, Queen, Parliament, to see the magic trick of turning bread without yeast into baby Jesus. Yes, so Henry's showing us that his reform is limited. The miracle of the mass is still in, and you better not call bullshit on that particular magic trick. That will make our Catholic Jane a happy queen. The Jane's in Henry's ear, though, talking up Lady, formerly Princess Mary. That started even before Anne was arrested. Jane was talking up Mary. Henry will say, Jane is a fool. She should be looking to advance her unborn kiddies with Henry and not talking up Mary. Jane will persist. No, Henry, see, I'm only doing what you asked. You want your own peace and happiness, and you want our kiddies to be happy, and you want the whole kingdom to be happy, and you want suitor sausage chuck off your back. And the way to do that is to restore Mary. Then everybody will be happy again. Otherwise, everyone will just continue to be shitty. Shafwee will be all congratulations, Jane. Without having to go through that messy childbirth stuff, you've got yourself a nice daughter. No, a marvellous daughter, Mary. And we'll say, yes, yes, thanks enough. That's enough of that. Thank you, Shafwee. Now, fuck off. Soon as Shafwee goes, Jane will be back to the nagging. Shafwee is off to Edward Seymour to talk up the restoration of Mary. It will do us all good, he says, and settle Christendom down after all that nastiness. Now, Lady, formerly Princess Mary, is rather excited about this. She and baby Betty are living in Hunston in Hertfordshire, and Lady Kingston, pretty fresh from being one of those women who stood with Anne at the scaffold, will arrive to give her the good news. Mary will immediately write to Cromwell seeking his help. Cromwell won't fuck about, and 4 days later, Mary will send him a letter thanking him for getting Henry's permission for her to write to him. Going well, isn't it? Better? 8th of June, and we have a letter from the lady, formerly Princess Mary, to Henry saying, yes, I understand you've forgiven me and withdrawn your displeasure, but my happiness will not be complete until I'm allowed to see you. I hope God will preserve you and Jane and send you a nice, bouncing baby prince. Going great, then. And then it'll go pear-shaped. 2 days later, she's back on a Cromwell. I desire you, for Christ's passion, find means that I be not moved any further entreaty in this matter than I have done, for I assure you I have done my utmost that my conscience will suffer me. Cromwell will reply, to be plain with you, I think you the most obstinate woman that ever was. I will never think of you other than the most ungrateful, unnatural, and most obstinate person living. And he'll finish by saying, you should be afraid. Yeah, it's the same problem as Sir St. Tom had. Mary won't take the oath. In comes a delegation headed up by Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, with a list of demands. Acknowledge Henry as a sovereign lord, accept all the laws and statutes of the realm, and acknowledge that her mum had not been married to a dad. Now, Anne Boleyn would have been very, very happy with that. Mary would just say, no way, Jose. Tom Howard will say, if you were my daughter, then I would knock your head against the wall so hard it would be soft as baked apples. You are a traitress and should be punished as such. Oh, fuck, are they threatening the bonfire? Off they go to tell Lady Shelton to hold Mary incommunicado. Now, clever Mary will manage to get a note or something off to Shafwee asking for advice.
There are more important things than living.
Yeah, no, Shafwee isn't some fuckwit USA Republican type. Well, you can't die, he says. See, just the opposite advice. You can't die, he says. So give in, but give as little as possible. Cromwell will write saying, sorry, we can't be friends anymore, and you need to sign the oath or else. And just watch your supporters now. Cromwell will arrest Lady Hussey, wife of Mary's former chamberlain. The Marquess of Exeter and Treasurer Fitzwilliam are suspended from the council. Sir Anthony Brown and Sir Francis Bryan Vicar from Hell will be brought in for a little chat. Sir Nicholas Carew is shitting razor blades. He's the top supporter of Mary. He'll write to Mary saying, for fuck's sake, submit and do what Cromwell says to do. Carew's Mrs. Elizabeth was Sir Francis Bryan, Vicar from Hell's sister, so Carew used his mother-in-law, Lady Bryan, to do the sneaking of the messages. The big danger is that the new Bill of Succession is still a work in progress through Parliament, so the existing bill remains law, and that means anybody who disputes Baby Betty's status as heir to the big chair is committing treason. Now, Baby Betty's status as heir to the big chair is about to be tossed out the window, but it doesn't matter. That's the law right now. Heads could come off if Mary doesn't submit. Cromwell would make sure that those people died so that they couldn't come back at him. Jane Seymour will do the kneeling and the boo-hoo-hooing to Henry. He's had enough of women crying, so sobbing won't do any good at all, and Henry will be rather bloody rude to her. Mary will work out that Carew is right. If she goes down, then her supporters will too. She'll sign whatever documents Cromwell wants signed. Full confession? Yeah, sure. There will be some resistance from her, though. It will be one by one, she concedes. Confession? Yeah. Henry, head of the church? Okay. Hang on, say the guys. There's his non-marriage to Catherine to go. That'll take Mary some time, but then, okay, it was incestuous and unlawful. Mary has signed away everything she has stood for and is a tiny bit broken.
And I cop all this shit all the time and I'm sick of it. Absolutely sick of it.
But she's alive and she's starting to sound like the run-of-the-mill princess, isn't she? Back in the court, and the courtiers will all be super happy. Dad and his kiddo will be reunited at last, and thank Christ none of us are in the slammer. Mary, though, is on a big downer. This girl could use a dildo-sized reefer right now. She'll talk to Chapuis, who will say, look, you did what you had to do. You had no choice. Even so, Mary will ask Chapuis to get the Pope to issue a super popey absolution. Otherwise, her conscience could not be at perfect ease. But she's back. Forget Lady formerly Princess Mary's ship. People are kneeling to her and asking for a pardon. And there's servants appointed to look after her, and nice new frocks, and a brand new Porsche-type horsey with a soft top. Best of all, after 5 years, Henry has agreed to meet with her. First meeting to be a small and private affair, and Henry will be all good dad, showering her with affection and promises. Jane will give her a big, fat diamond. Henry will give her 1,000 crowns for her little pleasures, new iPhone or whatever it is girlies want. It will be, I love you, Dad, and I love you too, my little princess. You can come back to court and be number 2 Sheila after Queen Jane. Mary is his big trophy. It's a symbol that he's won. This will be the time when the rumour starts that Cromwell wants to marry Mary, so his kiddies will inherit the big chair. It seems pretty fucking stupid, this rumour, as a lot of rumours are, but Cromwell won't help by having a ring made for Mary. Henry will say, no, mate, that ring's too good for you to give to her. I'll give it to her. You need to find some other gift for her. Now, the ring had an inscription. Show obedience to your dad. And that's hardly romantic, is it? Cromwell will find a nice horsey and a saddle to give her. And there's another scandal at court. What could it be? Lord Tom Howard began a secret courtship of Margaret Stuart, daughter of Henry's sister Margaret. And we need to catch up those Scotties. Perhaps next week. And I think I'd better get my brain into gear, because I think I just called her Margaret Stuart, but she's not a Stuart. She's the daughter of Margaret Tudor and Archibald Douglas. Now she is Margaret Douglas, a princess of Scotland. Back to this naughty relationship. This Tom Howard is Tom Howard's brother. I mentioned that ages ago, old Tom Howard, the really old one, he was the one who was at Flutton. Well, his son Tom Howard was at Flutton too, but anyway, the old Tom Howard. He had married twice, and those wives were cousins. He had a fucking heap of kiddies. So many, he must have forgotten that he had a Tom with wife number one, and then wife number two knocked out a boy, and he called that one Tom as well. So, yeah, he's got 2 sons called Tom. So these are half-brothers, as well as being cousins. Yeah, it's all a bit messy, isn't it? Here's an old Tom Howard, banged so long that our Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, is now about 63, while his brother-cousin the younger Tom Howard is about 24. Point being, Margaret is a Princess of Scotland, and the way things are in England, she'd be up there on the list of succession, so you can't go dating her without Henry's permission. Now, Margaret had been one of Anne's ladies. Henry will make an addition to the succession legislation, making it treason to espouse, marry, or deflower being unmarried any of his female relations. That's nice, and Henry can kill Tom Howard, the young one, if he wants to now. This would make it very stupid for Tom Cromwell, then, to be looking at Lady formerly Princess Mary as a bit of a girlfriend. Besides, Mary had zero reasons to even like Tom Cromwell. She's Catholic, he's a reformer. He masterminded the destruction of the monasteries and the break from Rome. He engineered Henry's divorce and got Anne in as queen, making Mary a bastard. He kept Mary away from Catherine and even took away that gold cross that Catherine had sent to Mary when Catherine was dying. Time now for that new act of succession. Will Mary be back to heir to the big chair? That's what she signed her principles away for, and... No. Baby Betty is now also Lady formerly Princess Betty, and now is heir to the big chair. The heir to the big chair is now Henry's unborn kiddies with Jane Seymour or any subsequent wife. Well, he's still planning ahead then. Now, this is a bit dangerous for England, no living heir. Henry, though, will include unprecedented powers for himself by including he can nominate any successor he wants to through his will.
Century, doing something mean to it, do it better than anybody you ever seen do it. Screams from the haters, got a nice ring to it. I guess every superhero need his theme music. No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop tripping, I'm tripping off the power. Broken, the school's closed, the prison's open, we ain't got nothing.
Yeah, power is what Henry wants, and he's getting it. Now, that was King I West. Now, that's an absolutely marvellous little film clip he put together. I love that. Bishop Fox will have a crack at introducing those Wittenberg articles at Luther and stuff, and Cranmer and Cromwell will back him up. But Henry's not up for it. It seems like he was a reformer, so far as it goes, to get a divorce from Catherine, but maybe that's his limit. Now, this will cause confusion to both sides, with Henry trying to find some sort of middle ground. And Henry, mate, there is no fucking middle ground with Christians. It's always, we're right and you're wrong, and you have to do everything our way, and that's how it goes. Now, on that basis, Henry will try to appease the reformers by signing off on some articles that Cromwell was pushing. Now, these cast doubt on purgatory. Purgatory. Perhaps it doesn't exist. And it will promote three of the seven sacraments only, so it's not a big deal. I don't think it's a big deal, but for Christians, it's a fucking huge deal, isn't it? Fucking huge. We've got to get all upset over this shit. Cromwell will get some education stuff into that parliament. That's nice. Churchy types to increase the number of scholarships to schools and universities. And it'll go into some detail about how little kiddies are taught. He says education is the key to having kiddies grow up as good people. Yeah, it certainly helps. While he's issuing these instructions to churchy types, he will tell them to lay off the booze and be a good example to the communities in how to lead a good life. Then the silly bugger will get all carried away and tell them to make sure that they've got the magic book in both Latin and English. Oh, fuck. He didn't have permission for the magic book in English. We've been burning people for having a magic book in English. Lastly, he will attack the cult of saints, and that will piss everybody off. And I might be getting off track here, because that's not what we started talking about. Mary supporters will be totally pissed off. Not only has the girl not got up as an heir to the big chair, but when they look for their share of the Anne Boleyn fortune, Cromwell just threatened that they could go the way of the Boleyn supporters. Now, he seems at this stage to actually have more power than even Wolsey had had, and he'll be hated even more than Wolsey for it. Cromwell, though, now is supporting Mary as hard as he could. That will get him into strife with Henry. Cromwell will tell Chapuis that he, Cromwell, has pissed Henry off so much he's worried he might be killed for it. Now, Cromwell was aware of those rumours that he wanted to marry Mary and joked about it openly. Valentine's Day, and we've got a kind of a Secret Santa thing going on in court. You draw out a name out of a hat and then you give that person a gift. Cromwell will draw Mary and give Tom Risley £15 to buy a present. Now, Risley was Cromwell's go-between for communication with Mary. But we might need to keep that in mind. Cromwell gave Mary a Valentine's Day present at a time when he was being accused of wanting to marry her. Cromwell now has the job of formalising the bastardisation of baby Betty. It will be repeal her status of heir to the big chair and then pronounce her illegitimate. Baby Betty is almost three now, and that's old enough for her to precociously ask, "How come I was a princess yesterday and a lady today?" That's a smart little cookie there. Lady Margaret Bryan will write a sharply worded letter to Cromwell. "How come nobody came to explain all this to Baby Betty, and I've had zero advice on what to do?" Now, fair enough, the council had been giving us step-by-step instructions constantly on what to do with Baby Betty, and now nothing, I don't care. We might expect Cromwell also to do nothing given Betty's new status, but he will do his best. Lady Bryan will go on to list a whole heap of grievances, and Cromwell, with his usual efficiency, will just sort the whole lot out. Meanwhile, Chapuis is writing that Cromwell has surpassed Wolsey in power and he is making lots of enemies. There's a growing mob of conservatives who will think about how can we get rid of him. Now, some art progress that had been delayed to get Anne's head off won't be reinstated. The dissolution of the monasteries, however, will gather pace. Jane Seymour will try to save a particular convent and fail. Henry will delay a silly beheading to October, but by September Ralph Sadler is telling Cromwell that Henry is having second thoughts about the whole thing. It could be that we've got some plague about the place, but Henry had made that decision after supper with Jane. Council will be called to discuss the decision, and it'll be, let's put it off for a while. Is it because Jane has failed to get up the spout? Is Henry looking around again? Chapuis will report that Henry had met a couple of hot chicks and sighed that he wished he'd met them before he'd married Jane. I don't think we're looking at true love again. Chapuis had written frequently during Anne Boleyn's time that the English would be rebelling any tick of the clock. And actually, it's after Anne's death and the English will rebel.
My lord! My lord! My lord! We have come here in great haste to tell you that a great part of the north, as well as parts of Lincolnshire, have risen in sudden rebellion against His Majesty. There are musters of the commons everywhere, and beacons of rebellion burning all night across the hills. Just 4 days ago, while we were collecting taxes in Hexham, we were set upon by an angry mob. They captured one of the commissioners called Nicholas Bellow, pulled him down from his horse, and beat him to death with their staves.
Among the mob, my lords, we saw armed priests urging on these rebellious knaves with cries of kill them, kill them. Then we heard that another man, William Leach, who was known to be in your service, Mr. Cromwell, had been hanged from a tree.
And what do these rebels say that they want?
Oh yeah, Tom, I'll tell you, don't worry about the bloody scriptwriter on the Tudors. The rebellion started in Lincolnshire, where we've got Lord Hussey, who won't offer much of a resistance at all. His missus will actually give him a feed, a drink and some money. The rebels will find a charismatic leader, Robert Aske, who will work out a coherent program. He wants the monasteries to be restored, Mary to be declared heir to the big chair, Cromwell, Rich and Audley to be declared evil advisers and killed, or at the very least, exiled. And Anne's bishops, including our Archie, Tom Cranmer, should be burned. Time for the royal family to close ranks. Jane, Mary and Baby Betty will be kept close. But it may not go too well because Jane's full of sympathy for the bloody rebels. She will do the kneeling and the boo-hoo-hooing. Oh, Henry, please restore the abbeys. Please, 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 Henry, restore the abbeys. Henry will say, get up and stop meddling in my affairs. And just remember how your predecessor Anne Boleyn went when she decided to meddle. Ooh, that's a bit nasty. Henry will drag out our, by now, very old Tom Howard out of retirement and tell him to go and sort those fucking rebels out. Tom will report back, sorry boss, no can do. Too many of the fuckers. You're going to have to negotiate. Richie Blackmore and Deep Purple there, Child in Time, to get us into some historical fiction. I had to play that because YouTube seems to think I want Child in Time covers, but it's a song that shouldn't be covered, I think. The latest one they sent to me was by Acoustic Rock Trio. Here is unser Version des Legendären von uns geliebten und immer gern gespielten Deep Purple, Child in Time. Yeah, didn't really work. Great band, like very good musicians, but yeah, you can't do it. But it's not about that, it's about historical fiction. And this week I had a crack at a novel, Viking Sword, first book in a series called the Earls of Mercia series by MJ Porter. Now, MJ Porter claims that he or she is an historian, but also points out that we know bugger all about the main character in this novel, which is Leofine, Ealdorman of Mercia. Not the more famous Leofine, this guy's son. And the only reason the guy's son is a bit more famous is because what we know about him is he married a girl, Godgifu, more commonly known as Lady Godiva. But this is a nice little easy tale that will take you along. And in his notes at the end, one of the things he points out is that he wants to try and rehabilitate the reputation of Æthelred the Unready, who I presented as a bit of a dick. Bit of a deal, really. That's basically because most historians say, yeah, he was a dick and a dill. So I'm going to keep reading this series to see what MJ Porter has got next to try and make Æthelred the Unready seem like a decent digger. But for us now, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And I'm feeling a bit chill this week, so I think we might go out with Faruka and the song Intro. Hope to see you next week. Bye.